Very good. Thanks. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks very much to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present our work. So I'd like to speak about our joint work with both Jutta Hagemann, Brian Swingle, Jordan Kotler-Klein, and Wien Volker-Scholz, some of which are in the audience, at least one I know is in the audience, on rigorous entanglement generalization for free fermion systems using wafer theory. And I'll sort of, well, try to explain what all this means in the coming half hour. I guess since this is the first talk, I get to introduce tensor networks, which is, of course, a great pleasure given that sort of the subsequent talks are, you know, are very pioneers of the field, be that as it may. So tensor networks states, as we know, are, you know, well, they're useful because they're efficient variation of classes for many interesting many-body quantum systems. So roughly speaking, that definition goes as follows. Suppose we have some, the idea goes as follows. Suppose we have some many-body quantum state psi. Then we can think of the coefficients of this quantum state as an index of many tensors, a tensor of many indices, one index for each system, for each subsystem, for each particle, say. The observation is that, you know, for many states of interest, these tensors are not completely unstructured and random, but they are very highly structured, and indeed they admit a graphical, oftentimes they can be well approximated in a graphical way. And this is exactly what tensor networks are about. So for example, so more precisely, the idea is to take this tensor with many indices and write it as a contraction of many tensors with few indices, and thereby represent this wave function in an efficient way. Okay. So here are two examples. One is matrix product states, describing, say, a quantum system on a line, on a discrete line. So each of these tensors have three indices, so we can store them efficiently. So if n of those, again, still efficient in the system size, and the resulting object describes an n-index tensor, which, naively speaking, requires exponential amounts of storage. Okay, so that's a matrix product state. Another example is MERA, the multi-scale entanglement generalization of Giffre. I'll talk more about MERA later on. So again, the only thing I want to point out is, again, so my network describes a one-dimensional system, but now there's some hierarchical structure going on that will be important. Some of these tensor networks, such as MERA, can have an additional interpretation, not only as tensor networks, but also as quantum circuits, which is useful because then you can interpret the network as a description for, as a prescription for preparing a state, you know, on a quantum computer. Now we care about tensor networks both because they're efficient, but also because they're a useful theoretical formalism. And this is because, in a sense, they geometrize the entanglement structure of a state, right? In this very pictorial way. And so any sort of family of tensor networks satisfies, if you like, a generalized kind of an area law, basically saying that the entanglement is bounded, the entropies are bounded by the size of minimal cuts for the network. Okay, so depending on how you choose a network, you sort of restrict the amount of entanglement that can be represented by your state. The other sort of useful thing is that oftentimes we can use tensor networks not only to describe a single state, but actually to sort of reorganize the quantum information on the physical indices, on these physical subsystems, in a logical way, or we can say, sort of, you know, pictorially speaking, we can sort of define very general kinds of bulk boundary dualities in these tensor networks. So this has been used, you know, for many purposes, to study quantum phases, topological order, renormalization group, and there's connections to holography and so on, and I think this will be touched upon in many of the subsequent talks this week. Very good. Now, I want to talk about tensor networks and the concept of quantum field theories, and there seems to be sort of a natural tension, right? Because sort of by the definition I gave you, tensor networks seem to be these discrete and finite objects, whereas, you know, quantum field theories are not, okay? And so there's basically two main approaches, as far as I understand, towards, you know, resolving this tension. One is we could discretize the quantum field theory, we could put it on a lattice, say, and then use these usual methods of matrix product state, PEPs, MERA, and so on. Or we could, you know, generalize the tensor network, the definition of a tensor network, to the continuum. So that's the second point. So there's the continuum version of MPS and MERA, and, you know, there's like a huge number of people who have, you know, made contributions to both of these very successful approaches. So this list is alphabetical, not chronological. I guess, yeah, very good. So now, whatever sort of route you choose to go, of course, the question is, like, how do you measure the goodness of the approximation given by this discrete and finite object, right? Or you could also ask, you know, suppose you made some choices, you know, some discretization choices and so on, you know, what does your tensor network actually describe? And of course, in practice, you know, we know how we can resolve these issues. So, for example, you know, we can look at observables that we care about, say energies. You maybe get the energies approximate right, then, you know, surely our tensor network describes the right physics. We could also sort of turn this question around, though, and we could ask, you know, suppose we have a set of data that we want to describe. Maybe we can we find an appropriate tensor network for it. Okay, so, and here's one way, one meta definition that one could take. So, you know, whatever the scenario, whether it's a continuous or a discrete theory, you know, so we suppose we have some many-body system in a stage row, and some choice of operators, maybe finite choice operators, some O sub alphas, you know, they might be sitting at different lattice sites, say, maybe with your favorite spacing. We could always, of course, define a correlation function, so a generalized kind of correlation function, you know, say, which has, say, n indices, alpha 1 to alpha n, and by definition equal to the expectation value of the corresponding product of operators, okay? And so now we could sort of turn this design question around. We could say, you know, suppose we have a certain collection of such operators, and the only thing we care about actually is you know, expectation value formed from these operators. And so we could say maybe the goal, reinterpretation of what has been done on the previous slide is to say that maybe our goal should be to design tensor networks that specifically target certain correlation functions, okay? And that's sort of a nice sort of interpretation, I think, because it sort of unifies, right, both the discrete and the continuum. So whether your initial system is discrete or has continuous degrees of freedom, there's a certain discreteness imposed not by the system but by the way we probe the system, okay? It's also clear that if you do have a tensor network for the state, then, you know, you could just ask it those questions, so you obtain tensor networks for these specific observables. But it might well be that this is not the optimal description, right? So suppose if I only care about, you know, correlation functions between two distant points, maybe I don't care about the fine scale physics in between. It's also somewhat clear that, you know, if your choice operator is sort of complete enough, that then you'll be able to recover the state. So really, this sort of is an interesting approach if you restrict yourself in the sort of questions you ask your physical system or the kind of properties you demand from your tensor network. So this perspective, I guess, has been sort of, you know, taken arisen sort of in the context, for example, of describing quantum Hall wave functions. And more recently, work by Robert Koenig, who's, I think, in the audience, and Volker Schultz, who's main co-author on this paper, on using matrix product states to approximate correlation functions for, I think, certain kinds of rational CFTs. And so that's really somewhere where we're starting from. Instead of building matrix product states, we want to build these MERA tensor networks that somehow we believe represent a renormalization in sort of a more direct way. And there's also connections to something I've been interested in for a while, the so-called quantum Martian problem. Is basically, you know, what kind of correlation functions can actually occur in a physical system, okay? Well, like when are they compatible with an underlying state? So that, I just wanted to mention this. So maybe now I can sort of briefly describe our results. So what we do is we construct tensor networks for simple model systems, free fermion systems. So we have sort of two kinds of systems. One is one-dimensional Dirac fermions, both discretized in the continuum. And then we also have results on a two-dimensional model, non-relativistic two-dimensional fermions on a square lattice. So again, these are very simple systems, but this means we get, you know, I guess, strong results. So we can rigorously prove that our tensor networks describe the correlation functions of these systems. The kinds of networks that we construct are versions of the of Giffre's MERA tensor networks. So they are MERAs, or so-called branching MERAs. Branching MERAs, I will briefly describe. They are generalization of MERA that support more entanglement. This is important in the two-dimensional model, because there we have a one-dimensional Fermi surface. And so some of the entanglement scaling requires us to have more entanglement. And we'll see how this arises naturally. And the construction is perhaps also interesting. It's an explicit construction of a circuit. It's not does not involve variation optimization, even though, of course, this can be done, and it's very successfully so. And we do construct these circuits based on, you know, insights from wavelet theory. Okay. And so most of all the lattice results I've talked about, they have already appeared in the paper mentioned on the first slide, and the continuum results will appear soon with Volker and Brian. All right, so now I get to introduce MERA. Very good. So that MERA is the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, and sort of from my perspective, there's sort of two dual ways of thinking about MERA. One is, you know, in the way I drew it, we can think of it as a quantum circuit. So we start with a product state, an unentangled state, and then we apply a bunch of gates, okay? And then at the end, we obtain a certain quantum state, okay? So it's a quantum circuit that prepares, you know, some many-body state from a completely unentangled state, okay? Now you see that the way I structure these lines, right? They kind of go over all these gates here, right? So I sort of push down these states that I started with to certain levels, to certain scales in this network. Okay, so this gives a second interpretation, which is sort of the entanglement normalization interpretation, if you like. So here the idea is basically that the circuit organizes quantum information by scale, if you like. So if we sort of read it from the bottom to the top, then the idea is sort of that we disentangle local degrees of freedom. So if we project them out at scale by scale, and then as we go up, we sort of have a more and more coarse-grained description. Okay. So is this a better pointer?
Visible.
Where do we point? Okay. Wow. I guess it helps with the green and red. By this sort of scale or self-similar design, mirrors are useful to describe critical systems. So the picture I drew was a one-dimensional mirror. So in this case, critical system 1D. Some of us are also excited about it because of possible relationships to holography, but maybe I will not go into this at this point. So this is mirror, key point is that a mirror organizes quantum information sort of by scale. And so it's natural to ask whether there's also a classical version of a mirror, so something that organizes classical information by scale. And such things do exist, and they are known as wavelet transforms. Okay. Roughly speaking, a wavelet transform takes a discrete classical signal. Now I get super confused. takes a discrete classical signal, its input here, and it again resolves the signal into different scales. A wavelet transform is, and so the outputs are, here is an output, here is an output, and so on. You see the pattern. Now each of these signals, they're on the line, right? So they're really spatially extended. My picture doesn't sort of do this justice. So it's just as before, there's a spatial extension to all the signals. How is this wavelet transform defined? Well, there's two ingredients. There's two filters by which one can define this transformation. One is a low-pass filter, this H, and a high-pass filter, G. So basically what happens is you take your input signal, you convolve it with either the high or the low pass filter, coarse grain it, this is this coarse graining here, and then you either keep it in this case, or you have removed the local high frequency components, or you feed it in, feed the output into the next layer, and so on and so forth. So this is an isomorphism, it's a unitary, and it just reorganizes the classical information. Okay. And so the key idea, the key fact now is that we learned from Glenn is, that by second quantizing such a one-dimensional wavelet transform, we get exactly something that is a mirror. It's a certain special mirror, it's a Gaussian mirror in this case, but this we can do. Okay. And in fact, we can even because this is a unitary transformation, we actually get a unitary transformation from states on this lattice to all these different outputs. So again, so we sort of spatially resolve this quantum state at the bottom. Both, we reorganize it both by scale and by precision. Okay, and so this is, we could think of this as holographic mapping. So Xiao Lang had this exact holographic mapping some years ago, and so this he did exactly this with the Haar wavelet, as I understand. This is sort of a general fact, though, and you can really relate the properties of the wavelet transform and of the mirror tensor network. For example, the length of these filters, right? These are finite filters usually, translates pretty directly into the depth of these quantum circuits. And so now, if we have a free fermion system, say, right, so we can, because it's a free system, we can work in the single particle picture. And so, and suppose we want to produce a ground state of such a system, then really all we want to do is we want to design wavelet transforms that are exactly adapted to these positive and negative, eigenmodes of a single particle Hamiltonian. So if we can do this, then it's sort of clear that we can we can fill the Fermi C and we exactly excite these negative energy modes, leaving the others unoccupied. So that's the goal. Okay. So here's I want to show you sort of half explicitly how to do this in the one-dimensional case. So this is one-dimensional Dirac fermions discretized on the lattice. So we have these B1s and B2s. We could, for example, think of them as sitting on even or not lattice sites, for example, and then these they are hopping around. So for example, B2n goes to B1 n dagger and so on and so forth. Be that as it may, the details of the model are not so important here. What is important, of course, is that it's a translation variant model, so we can Fourier transform to diagonalize it. Okay, so this is what someone else happily has done for us on the slide. So after going to Fourier space, only these two modes, B1, B2, interact. And so we have this certain one single particle Hamiltonian sitting here in Fourier space. Now we can diagonalize the single particle Hamiltonian by a matrix, the K-dependent matrix that, you know, is basically Hadamard transformation sitting over here, and a diagonal matrix. So the diagonal matrix with a 1 and 1 component and minus a certain phase factor on the other component. So the phase factor is, turns out to be minus I times sine of the momentum times e to the ik over 2. So now if you do so, okay, so I assert that this diagonalized matrix is not important that it does, but you can vary, you can sort of calculate it. What you find is that the diagonalized single particle Hamiltonian looks as follows, right? Because this is a traceless matrix, there's one positive and one negative eigenvalue, and one is the negative of the other. So there's some E minus, some E plus. And so what we want to do, of course, that once we've achieved this Fourier transform, the only thing we have to do is we have to fill these negative energy modes while leaving the positive energy modes unoccupied. Okay. But the trouble is, of course, that a Fourier transform is not a local transformation, right? So it's not clear how you do this on a finite depth quantum circuit. But the good thing, on the other hand, is that we don't actually need to do the Fourier transform. The only thing we have to achieve is basically that we want to produce pairs of modes that are related by the right phase relation. Okay, so somehow the idea will be that, you know, instead of, you know, trying something like discretizing, you know, sort of approximating the Fourier transform, we are looking at two different wavelet transforms such that the modes generated from one wavelet transform are related to the modes generated by the other wavelet transform in such a way that they're exactly related by this phase relation. Okay, so that's a unitary sort of the difference sort of is a unitary, right? So this phase operation Fourier space. So this can be done. Okay, so. There exist pairs of wavelet transforms. It turns out that the only property we need is that the high-pass filters of the wavelet transform are related by this very phase factor. Then we can compute that sort of for tools more generally. And what's quite interesting is that actually this design problem of constructing pairs of wavelet transforms that are related in this way had been studied previously in the classical signal processing community, sort of in part motivated by designing wavelet transforms that were translation variant, which is of course very nice, right? Because these are, again, we have the translation variant quantum systems, so it suggested there's some deeper connection that one could explore in more general connections, in more general situations. Okay. Now it's plainly impossible to achieve this phase difference with finite filters, right? Because there's sort of a discontinuity. I guess the phase difference is plotted here and as a sort of this sharp function here. But you can approximate it to arbitrary accuracy. And this has actually been done in this community by Selesnik and colleagues. So there exists basically algorithms that produce to you filters, pairs of wavelet transforms, such that the outputs are exactly related by this phase relation up to arbitrary goodness. And some of the quality of the approximation, you know, increases much faster than the length of the filters. So these are sort of good approximations. The only takeaway message from this picture is that, you know, there seem to be some continuous function that sort of approximate this relation. The different colors, L equals 1, L equals 2, L equals 3, they correspond to the different sort of layers of the wavelet transform. So whether you look at this mode or at this mode, okay. So you see somehow there's additional wiggles coming in, but it turns out they are in areas where actually the function has not much support, so this is actually a good approximation. Okay, so take away message so we can design these objects. And so now we just simply second quantize, and we had two wavelet transformations that we second quantize, so we get two mirrors. So one is sort of, I guess it's kind of hard to see on the screen. So there's one sitting here, and then sort of this sort of solidly shaded boxes, and then these other boxes, they correspond to the second wavelet transform. And they seem to be independent, but what we want to do is, of course, we want to have at the same time, right, a mode on the even sublattice and on the odd sublattice, say, that are related by the phase difference. So we have to sort of entangle them over here, right? So basically what this picture amounts to is occupying a superposition of a mode on the even and on the odd sublattice that are exactly related by the right phase relation. Okay, so this can be done. And so maybe I'll want to discuss now what are these rigorous approximation guarantees that we can get from the simple construction. For this, I have to sort of tell you what the parameters are, okay, and maybe it looks a bit technical. So there's a bunch of things we can choose. So we can choose the number of layers in the network plainly, right? We want a finite representation, so we'll cut it off at some point. Then something else is this, basically the accuracy of this phase relation on the single particle level, on the level of these high-pass filters, right? So this is something finite that we can just compute. This is epsilon. And W is, roughly speaking, the size of these filters. I don't want to go into much detail here. It's, roughly speaking, the length of the filters. And now, the kind of result that we get is the following. So we look at correlation functions, for example, built from N creation and N annihilation operators. So there's this B daggers, BJ1 to JN, These are, you know, either one or two. F are some observer, okay, so this is the corresponding creation annihilation operators. So we look at correlation function of this sort, supported on some number of letter sites, and then the kind of results we really get are, you know, a rigorous approximation result. So the correlation function computed using the exact ground state, minus one computed using a mirror, they are very close, and basically let me just run you through the way that these errors enters, because of, I think it's sort of, you know, it's intuitive. So as we increase the number of layers of the network, so this 2 to the minus L goes down, so that's sort of intuitive. But on the other hand, right, there's a maximum, so not only should this number be small, but also epsilon should be small. And you'll remember that epsilon was the accuracy of this phase duration, right? So but what I'm saying is basically we need many layers because then, you know, we are adding more and more modes to the Fermi C, right, so that we don't see any problems. But also, we, of course, we need to get the phase duration right because otherwise the modes that we occupy are not actually negative energy modes. So these are the two things, and both have to be small in order for this expression to be small, and this, it can be achieved using this algorithm, using this explicit construction. Of course, the observables in the correlation function, they also enter the bounds, so they enter through S and N. S was the basic support of these observables, and N was the N in, you know, how many operators do we have in the correlation function. So we had two N, well, N creation N and N annihilation operators here. So that's the kind of results that you can expect, and, you know, so it's really, these are really a priori results, like you don't have to optimize and you don't have to guess, so this, you know, unless you made a mistake, really just true. So that's that. I guess I don't want to run you through these pictures except to show that we didn't trust our theorem, so we also did some numerics. So you see that the energy error decays exponentially with the bond dimension, which is what you like. With the number of bond qubits. The entropy scales logarithmically, which is good. And you can also see if you, okay, so these are, you know, Green's function, or two-point functions. And you see that, well, I guess you don't see because the screen is somewhat grainy. The point is sort of, as you increase the bond dimension, the correlation function becomes translation invariant as it should be. This is sort of what one could see you know, in an ideal image. Okay, so then maybe I'll briefly sketch how one can generalize now to these other scenarios, on the one hand side to the continuum, on the other side to this two-dimensional model. So in the one-dimensional case, okay, so in the continuum, we really want to solve the in our case, okay, these were massless fermions, okay, so now we solve the massless Dirac equation in 1 plus 1 dimension, which, for example, looks as follows. Now, if we sort of, you know, identify I delta T with the energy and minus I delta X with the momentum, then sort of in single particle picture, basically, it looks as follows, right? So now for the first component of this spinner, we have that the energy equals momentum. For the other one, the energy is minus the momentum, okay, so we have to... in the first component, we want to, you know, basically fill all negative energy modes. In the second, we want to fill all positive energy modes. So in the, you know, in this picture, it corresponds basically to this piece, to that piece. So again, we need wavelet transforms, but now we need wavelet transforms that somehow allow us to build modes that are only supported on the negative momenta or only on the positive momenta. Okay. So how could one go about this? Well, somehow, you know, following the sort of story I told, it's sort of maybe natural to do it directly on the level of wavelet transforms. And basically what you want to do is, you know, maybe I'll just call this the continuum limit of these wavelet transforms, by which I really mean the following. What I mean is the following. So this is the inverse wavelet transform. It's sort of, you read it from the right to the left. It corresponds to the synthesis picture where we create the quantum state going down in my Mera picture. So when I say continuum, basically what I mean is the following. So suppose I insert some signal into this high frequency component somewhere here, and then I do many steps of this inverse wavelet transform. So there's many sort of, you know, inverse steps going to the right, not just one additional layer, but many layers. Then turns out that this output signal actually sort of approximates a continuous function. It's called the wavelet function. It's sort of where the name comes from. It's sort of the continuous perspective on wavelet transformations. And I'll just assert this, and I will not prove it, but it is true that if you have a pair of wavelet transforms, as before, where the filters are related by the phase relation of the discrete lattice fermions, then in this limit, so to say, actually the outputs will be related by basically, you know, rescaled properly by simply I times sine of k. So this e to the ik over 2, basically, we can ignore. And we are very happy, right, because we have two modes which are related in Fourier space basically by the sine, or I times the sine. So by simply linearly combining these two modes, right, so for example, psi 1 plus I times psi 2 will be supported only on negative momenta, and psi 1 minus I psi 2 will be only supported in positive momenta, and that's the way by which we can now really, do the same story, but now direct in the continuum. We can prove that, some smooth and local observables, if you take smooth and local observables, we look at the corresponding correlation functions, then they will be well approximated, okay? So that's a continuum story. And maybe a last thing I want to explain is somehow, so again, following the story that we should really be working on the wavelet level, I want to tell you how to discuss this two-dimensional setup. It is easy to see that the Hamiltonian I gave you before can be rewritten up to local unitaries, basically, in the following form, where we basically just have a single fermion species hopping on a lattice, okay? So that happens to be equivalent up to local unitaries to what we did before. And so from this perspective, though, there's another natural generalization of the model to two dimensions, where instead of hopping on a discrete line, I hop on, say, a discrete square lattice, okay? And so that's what we'll do, okay? So here we have non-relativistic fermions hopping on a 2D square lattice, tough filling, as it turns out. So we have two spatial coordinates, M and N, and indeed, we hop either to the right or to the left, or, up or down. Now, this is an interesting model because it has a one-dimensional Fermi surface. So if I plot the dispersion relation in this picture here, and I intersect it with energy zero, you'll find that it intersects in a square. It's the same square as over here. So there's a very simple, but there is a one-dimensional Fermi surface, which means, in particular, that we expect the area law to be violated, so that entropies of subsystems, they don't purely scale like the linear size of the boundary size, but actually are as the boundary size times the logarithm, okay? So that means that we have to know it's not sort of a simple mirror will not be enough. You want to have a branching mirror, for example, and we'll come to this in a second. The good news, though, is that actually this is a very simple theory, of course, and by sort of, rotating our coordinate system by 45 degrees, actually, it turns out that, for example, the Green function factorizes, everything factorizes, and so a natural approach in these new coordinates actually is to simply, so basically what I'm saying is that basically these two diagonal directions, they decouple, and so it's sort of a natural construction is to use the tensor product of the wavelet transformations and then to second quantize. So that's what I want to do. So again, I want to solve this problem on the single particle level, and so this is what comes out of it. So if I denote a single step of the wavelet transform by W, right, so I took a discrete signal on the line, I resolve it into high and low frequency components, or scaling and wavelet components, so these are low and high frequency components, then the tensor product, of course, of these two transformations now has two outputs. They have like a scaling output, a wavelet scaling wavelet, and a wavelet corresponding to all combinations of low frequency, high frequency in x direction, and low frequency, high frequency in the y direction, okay? And so now we can happily quantize this, and what we obtain is a tensor network that has roughly the following structure. So we have our two-dimensional system sitting here. We first do wavelet transformations along all the x directions, say, and then we have, for each x slice, so to say, we have like one high frequency and one low frequency output. And now we do wavelet on both of these outputs, we do wavelet transforms in the other, in the y direction, and again, we have either a scaling or a wavelet output, either a low frequency or high frequency output, okay? So these are these four outputs, and I denote them by SX, SY, WX, and so on, corresponding. So again, scaling is low frequency, wavelet is high frequency. So now, well, how do I proceed? In the case that I'm sort of high frequency with respect to both axes, I'm done. I'll just try to project out this degree of freedom, if you like. If I'm sort of high frequency, in one direction, say in the y direction, but low in the other direction, I want to continue doing wavelet transforms, but only in the x direction. So what this picture is supposed to say is that basically we continue doing these one-dimensional mirrors to the x output, so the x directions, while leaving y untouched. Okay, so we get sort of a tree of one-dimensional mirrors sitting here. Likewise for the other combination. And now lastly, in the case that we are sort of low frequency with respect to both one-dimensional wavelet transformations, well, we have just basically coarse-grained and we just repeat the same structure. So this entire circuit is repeated over here and over here and so on. And so this is not quite like a mirror, it's more like a branching mirror. One can show that it has the capacity to support a logarithmic violation of the area law, and one can prove a similar approximation theorem in this case. Okay, so maybe now I should conclude. I guess what I wanted to talk about I want to talk about these quantum circuits that we could construct that rigorously approximate the correlation functions of simple free fermion systems. They, I guess their key features was apart from this approximation result, which sort of was, you know, sort of a proof of concept of the strategy of targeting a tensor network to correlation functions rather than to the state. We sort of obtained these quantum circuits from by second quantizing Wechsler transform with desirable properties, which of course is only true in this non-interacting case. So that's the two pictures here. And I guess there's much, many things to understand how about massive theories, Dirac cones rather than, you know, Fermi surfaces like these straight lines. How about, you know, I guess, particularly in the continuum theory, how about if you insert operators at different times? Like, what does it mean on the tensor network level? So these are all things we're thinking about. We're thinking about extending these free fermions and the continuum to Vesemir-Witten models with Volker and Brian. Okay, natural question, you know, is all this relevant for interacting theories? So maybe as a starting point for relation optimization, I'm not sure. Okay, so thanks very much.
Thank you, Michael, for this very nice talk. We have time for questions. David Gossett has a question in the back.
Yes, so you presented results on for 1D and 2D systems of fermions. What about just general quadratic Hamiltonians in the creation annihilation operator?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, something I don't have a good answer, but it's a natural question. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Something thinking about.
So you've been talking about correlation functions. How well do you get the wave function? I mean, given it's free fermion, somehow the two-point correlation functions carry all the information about the wave function. So can you bound the accuracy for the total wave function?
Well, somehow, I guess the pictures I showed you were sort of in the thermodynamic limit. So you could try to do those things. Basically, if you can sort of, if you sort of close, say, to, you know, to the desired energy. So suppose you do a finite system, right? Then somehow, you know, there is some gap, and so if you get the two-point functions well enough, you get the energy well enough, then you can bound the overlap. So that's something you could do. I'm not sure if.
Wavelet construction gives you a free fermion wave function, or that's an interacting wave function, or it doesn't give you any kind of wave function. It gives you a wave function.
Well, it gives us a quantum state, and for certain questions that you ask this quantum state, it gives the same predictions as the true wave function.
Okay, but it's not.
But it does produce a free fermion wave function.
Sorry, it does, or it doesn't?
The covariance matrix of free fermion wave function. So it's a Gaussian. It's a Gaussian.
But the total wave function itself is Gaussian. You get that way.
Yeah.
Okay, but then it's basically specified by the two-point correlation function.
Right, so but so I guess the question is like, what norm, what distance measure do you use to compare? And I think that's kind of the sub. One way of making this formal is via the correlation function, right?
Okay, so Frank Verstrada has a question.
Yes, I have a question about this two-dimensional versions. It seems that this branching structure comes out of the fact that you get a square for your Fermi surface. So what happens if your Fermi surface would be a circle or something?
We don't know. I mean, we don't know. It's a good question. I mean, maybe one could.
So would you need infinitely many of those towers?
Yeah, so I'm not sure. Like, I guess there was an idea that maybe one could sort of locally the Fermi surface looks flat, so maybe one could patch together pieces or something. But I'm not sure. I don't have a good answer. Yeah. So right now we're really using somehow a lot of explicit knowledge about this model to design the network. Yeah, it's a great question.
So I have actually a question, which is. So in principle, since you know that this is a free theory and translation invariant, you should be able to diagonalize it using the Fourier transform and implement the Fourier transform through the fast Fourier transform, which has a structure like branching Mera. So the question is the structure that you're exploiting here exactly that, or is this something beyond the fast Fourier transform that Wavelet can do?
It's a great question. I'm not sure if you could reinterpret it. So here, our momentum are really continuous because we work working in the continuum limit. So I'm not sure how this matches with the fast Fourier transform, which I somehow know best for finite systems. I wonder though if you say on a finite, it's a good question. Maybe we can think about it. Yeah. So a priori, there's no relation like this. Yeah. But maybe one can sort of view our construction from this, you know, from this perspective, make a connection. Yeah. So here, kind of our point of view here was really that, in order, like, one way of avoiding implementing the Fourier transform is by instead of, you know, having one transform, to have two transforms that are related in an interesting way in Fourier space, but each individual mode somehow is not a Fourier transform. Each individual transform is not a Fourier transform. So we'll sort of this relative phase difference that was important for us.
Yeah. Oh, can I go? Yeah, so you said this always produces a Gaussian ground states, but is this because you made a special choice of gates, or, I mean, could you use this as a variational ansatz for interacting theories?
I mean, sort of, I guess by design, when we went from this this wave transformation, I guess we obtained a quantum circuit that is a Gaussian unitary. I guess in principle you could sort of embed this, general Hilbert space and start from there. But yeah.
But what would you need to relax in the Mera construction to get something that is not Gaussian?
Well, I guess I'm not sure how to do it starting from directly from wavelets. Like somehow it seems to me that somehow the way of getting from a wave sort of unitary transformation on the single particle picture by second quantizing, it will always give me something Gaussian. So I'm not sure from this side. Yeah. Okay. So I guess ideas would be, can we somehow learn something about these kind of modes that are produced by the Mera as starting points? So that might be a way. But yeah, it's a good question.
So I have a computational question. So when you calculate, expectation values of the energy or these operator scaling dimensions, do you have to actually evaluate the boundary state explicitly, or is there some computational speed up by using this wavelet formalism?
I mean, here you can really do everything in a single particle picture. So basically, you only work with the wavelet transforms. You never actually write down a tensor network. Yes.
You can calculate quite large systems explicitly, I suppose.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's really like it's all the basic covariance matrices. That, yeah.
So if there are no further questions, then we'll thank Michael again and welcome to Dupree.